following programming is sponsored by
MBC Media.
The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you.
And good afternoon again, Philadelphia. Welcome back to WWDB AM 860, the conservative voice. We had a great first hour. That was fascinating. It was really fun to talk to Ezra Cohen and get some of his firsthand direct ideas of what he saw when he was in the White House. This hour we have with us Lieutenant Colonel Darren Gobb, who's been,
also super cool.
Yeah, who was with us last night for a fabulous town hall.
I'm just as excited to talk to you as I was to Ezra. I just want you to know.
Yeah. My White House days were a little bit before his.
Yeah, maybe.
I didn't know I was there either.
Yeah. And so Darren is, the listeners know him because he's been on the show now a bunch of times. We're just glad to have you here with us in the studio this afternoon and be able to have this in person. We're going to go the full hour. Now, if you've got questions and you want to ask questions, we're going to cover some pretty interesting stuff. We're going to try to be quick about it, but we're going to cover a lot of stuff. If you want to have a question asked, just dial 888-329-3306. It's 888-329-3306, and we will try to get you on should you have a question here in the latter part of this first hour. So feel free to do that. We'd love to hear from you if you've got something you want to ask Darren about. So I don't know, Darren, if you heard the first part of our conversation today, but a lot of it is about voting.
Yeah.
We want to get people out, and you've got somewhat of a unique perspective on what the meaning of this election really is, because you've been on the front line of our endless wars, right? You've been out there and seen the impact it has on our people and on the people in these other countries. And one of the things I think that you were involved in was planning the exit from Afghanistan. And that was something that became really a significant political issue when it happened. And people in America were shocked at what happened when, the explosion.
Which, to note, wasn't part of your plan, right?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. So when you say I planned the exit from Afghanistan, that was version of 2012 and 13.
That's right. Why I say it the way right. That's the hook, right?
Sorry, yeah.
So tell us. Did they follow your plan?
So you wrote this thing up for them, did they?
Let's start with step one. From where do you pull people out of the country? Bagram.
Right.
After that, it's follow the plan. Once you move it from Bagram to Kabul, it's all changed. So whatever I wrote, whatever I worked on over there, was not applied.
Well,
it showed.
It's crazy because the Harris-Biden administration blamed Trump for the chaotic withdrawal and said that they followed his plan. So are you saying they lied to us?
I know that probably comes as a shock to you and your listeners that they would do such a thing.
Wow.
I'm very familiar with how Trump operated with regards to Afghanistan and the conditions that he laid out in order for there to be an eventual successful withdrawal. Because we did have to leave the country at some point.
Yes. Yeah.
But we needed to leave on our terms in accordance with a plan that would work.
Right.
And so if you're going to look at plan A, and plan A would generally work and be a good thing, well, after the inauguration, what happened was plan B got put into effect. And this plan B said, let's see how badly we can fail.
Well, the way I've described it to people is plan. So for folks that don't know, when you say Bagram, you're talking about the best air base in the region, an air base that we spent, I don't know, billions building. I mean, over time, because it was built and expanded. I don't know that they could track how much they spent on it. But this was a tremendous base that was big, right? And so you're saying that from there, that's where you plan to exit. Why? Why Bagram?
Yeah. Well, the easiest thing to do is compare it to something that people are familiar with here in the local area. So imagine trying to evacuate people out of Philadelphia Airport.
Oh, yeah.
And make Philadelphia Airport a dual-use military and civilian airfield surrounded by high-rise apartment buildings that can all see into the airfield itself. and now make sure all the population around, or most of the population around, really either hates Americans or is going to go along with the Taliban because that's who's coming next. The opposite of that is Bagram. Bagram's your giant airfield surrounded by walls, only military use in the middle of Kansas, surrounded by nobody.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
And so Kabul Airport, that I've been into hundreds and hundreds of times from the air and the ground, is actually the worst location to do that operation from.
Right. You can, I mean, you can just,
the perfect.
You can see it. You can see what happened. You can see the videos from that period of time, and you can clearly understand why that was a catastrophic decision.
Right. And because it's so easy to
see. Accessible, yeah.
But is there is
the
there
entire...
Yeah.
You just like look in through the fence. I mean, they could see what was happening.
Why wait to get to the fence when you can see into the airfield from the fifth floor apartment building that was just across the street?
That you can fire from, that you can launch an RPG from, right?
Yeah. I mean,
you could, so there could be inbound from that vantage point. And none of that existed at Bagram, which was in an isolated area and was large enough and defended well enough to be protected.
Right. That's why the Russians liked it. That's why the Chinese apparently are enjoying it right now.
Wait, what is that? What do you mean? The Chinese. How did they get into Bagram?
I'm pretty sure they came across the undefended border.
Might be the way.
But, they were there as early as 2004 when I first saw them. They were working on staking out mining claims and mineral rights in Afghanistan because they knew eventually that they were wanting to control that part of it. And so the Chinese will work with the Taliban.
Of course.
They don't really care.
No.
So in the end, they got what they wanted. And as soon as we left Bagram, they basically moved right in. And it was completely expected.
Was there some, though, I mean, was there some logic to this? I mean, was there some, was it too far apart? Or, you know, is Bagram 4,000 miles away from Kabul? Or, I mean, who would, you know, is there some reason for this?
I can't come up with a logical one.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I keep writing articles like Failure is the Plan.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to fail this bad, you actually have to work at it.
You almost have to want to fail.
Right.
Is what you're saying. I mean, this wasn't a hard call. This was an easy call to do it out of Bagram. They made the decision to do it out of Kabul. They're what, 35 miles apart, something like that?
Yeah, and for me, it was always a 12 to 13 minute flight in a Black Hawk. That's my...
Yeah, you commuted effectively then back then. That was efficient commuting. But the point I'm trying to get to is that there is really no answer that makes any sense as to why you would choose to leave out of this undefendable airport in Kabul as opposed to this massive airbase that was secure. And frankly, many people believe we should have never abandoned Bagram. That doesn't mean we had to stay in this occupying role, and maybe there was some way to figure it out. But when the U.S. forces moved out of Bagram and then exited through Kabul, the Chinese moved into Bagram.
Yep.
So they followed right behind.
Right, yeah. And by the way, on this most recent anniversary of our departure, when you saw the parades again,
yes,
of Taliban driving our equipment,
yeah,
what a lot of people didn't point out was that some of the equipment they were actually driving was not American, and it was Chinese made.
So they're being resupplied.
Yeah.
So they're using the $80 or $85 billion worth of gear we left behind. They enjoyed that.
And the money we're sending.
Some of the helicopters, maybe not, because I think they might have crashed a couple.
Yeah, their maintenance program wasn't the greatest.
And I'm not sure their skills. I mean,
they didn't really know what they were doing. I think it was like learning on the job, learning, right. Which is could be
tough on a Black Hawk.
Pretty tragic. Yeah,
Apache. So the Chinese have developed that relationship. We were in there for 20 years. We spent, I think we lost 15,000 people between Iraq and Afghanistan, roughly, if you count contractors and.
Right. Yeah.
Because I count. The contractors were contracted with CIA and for whatever, and there were our people, and so. But there were about 900,000 others killed in that war.
Yeah,
I think
by the time you put everything together,
so it was $7 trillion or $8 trillion. You know, 915,000 people, 920,000 people, and when we left, we simply handed it to the Taliban and the Chinese Communist Party.
Right, and made them both better in the process.
I mean, this is, you know...
This is what we do. We finance our enemies. We buy oil from Russia so that they can finance their military program. We send money to Ukraine so that they can money launder it. We send money to Hamas and to Israel. So both sides are funded.
That's right.
We release billions to Iran so that they can fund the Houthis, Hamas, Taliban. I mean, the list, ISIS, the list is endless.
Trump sanctioned the Nord Stream 2 pipeline for a reason, so Russia couldn't fund their conflicts.
Right.
That's right.
So, and then we're shocked when they have money to buy weapons from China or invade other countries.
And from Iran.
Emboldened it.
I don't think they need money. If you're in Afghanistan, you don't need money to buy things from China. You simply give them access to your raw materials, right? Everybody wants those resources.
It's
minerals.
An exchange. Whether it's paper money or bullion or other precious minerals, it's all the same to the Chinese.
It's trading. They don't have to go through the SWIFT system. They don't have to, you know, they can simply say, come on in, you can have some minerals, give us the weaponry.
Well, and it sounds like what you were talking about last night, they're pretty desperate to diversify their income right now. Yeah. They need to find more money.
But this Afghanistan thing, I mean, to do that, to spend that kind of time, 20 years, and hand it to your enemies, this is not something unknown. This wasn't a mistake or an accident. This was a policy move. This was a policy decision. Because I don't think, you know, your depth of knowledge in this is incredible because you spent so much time there. But if we took a carpenter, a teacher, a lawyer, and an accountant over there and said, okay, how would you do this? They probably would have gone with your plan to exit through Bagram. And they probably wouldn't have said, let's spend 20 years and all this resources, blood and treasure, and then hand it to the CCP and the Taliban. That, you know, I'm guessing they'd come up with that. So we have a unique problem in our leadership is what I'm getting to. We have a unique problem in our leadership. You think of the fighting men that went over there, the support teams, the expertise in logistics, and think of the medical facilities where if you were injured, as I understand it, on a battlefield in Iraq, you were 17 minutes away from a surgeon's table. I don't know if that's the right number, but it was pretty quick.
Close enough for what we're talking about.
Okay.
And the whole point is we were able to reach out and grab people very quickly off the battlefield, bring them back to a hospital, get them recovered. And if they couldn't stay in country, we could still evacuate them by C-17 or something very quickly. And through Germany, back to the United States, whatever that route took, we could do that. And it's an incredible feat of logistics. And then we show what we're capable of. And to flip around and to have that happen, it's a wasted 20 years of effort for all the people who were there. Because if you're going to be there doing that, you want to actually see Afghanistan thrive and not be a hive of, to use a Star Wars term, scum and villainy.
Right.
And growing terrorism once again, but now using our stuff.
And this is where I think it's important we really think that through. So we took these incredible people. And they really are. I mean, we all know this now. I mean, if we're paying attention to what's going on in our military, the capabilities, these incredible resources, the incredible capabilities, we invested them in something that we specifically seemed to want to lose. And in the end, exited in the most disastrous way we could. Now, here's a question. Leaving Afghanistan, did that affect the way the world views us, the way that went, the way we exited, the destruction and death and embarrassment? How did that impact our image in the world stage?
You know, that's actually the biggest price we did pay in the end. And we know that we can't discount the 20 years and the money spent and the most importantly, the people lost.
Yeah.
But what that sent out to the different dictators and leaders around the world was that America is different. They're not the American people, not the heart and soul of this country, but you know, the cancer that is infecting our nation and our national body through Washington, D.C. They said, well, they're weak. They're indecisive. They're not going to do what they have to do to win and protect their own people. So there's no way they're going to protect or get involved in some other things as well. And so what did you see? Shortly after that evacuation, Putin said, this looks like a great time.
Yeah.
Because of what Biden didn't promise, what he didn't follow through with, and the message he sent was, we have a window of opportunity here. If we need it, we take it now because you may not get it again.
Right.
And the number of evacuations from embassies, right? Like, I didn't see any of them under Trump. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure we saw no helos taking off of roofs of embassies between 2017 and 2020, beginning of 2021. And since Biden's been there, how many embassies have we had to evacuate? Because people see our weakness and they're like, perfect. This is a perfect time to do what we want to do, whatever bad deeds. And they've essentially allowed it and permitted it.
How about kidnapping U.S. Marines in Turkey?
Yes.
I mean, all these things are just an outgrowth
Well, there's still U.S.
people looking at the U.S. going, they're not going to do anything that matters.
Right. And it's not that they're incapable. It's not the United States is incapable. It's not that we don't have the talented. It's not that. It's that they've got a leadership team that is unwilling to do what's necessary to defend the United States, right? And also then to be a good actor on the world stage, to be right. a positive force on the world stage.
And right. you heard that from the men and women who were nearby to North Carolina mountains after Hurricane Helene hit. And they're like, we want to go. We are here and we can go. We can help. We are not being sent. They're not putting the orders out to send us. So, yeah, I mean, it's a clear leadership issue. It's not a lack of will or desire from the men and women who have selflessly signed up to serve our military. But we do have an enlistment problem now. And why is that? Same problem, same yep. reason, same result.
Out of good leadership comes good organizations. And once you have that in place, and that leadership is key, especially with the military, then you'll get back the military that you truly want. And like you said, what are we capable of? Incredible and amazing things. Just the fact that we could continue to fly these, you know, bombers across the world.
Yeah.
And drop things on targets and return home. In some nations, that's in a feat of arms that they'll never be able to reach. But we can do that as kind of sort of a matter of course.
We yeah. take that as for granted. We take
certainly.
For granted that, you know, that we've got that, as they call it, over the horizon capability.
Right? Yeah.
But if you have the greatest ship in the world and an incompetent captain, you have problems.
There you go. And you know, our ship is at this point rudderless.
Taken on water. We're taken on water.
We're rudderless. Yeah. I mean, we've got a captain that is just incapable of steering.
Drunk,
the vessel.
Maybe.
Can't do
right.
it.
And why do we, and for some reason, we still, if polls are right, and whole other discussion, why would half of a country want to reinforce constant and terrible failure?
Well, there's a great point. And of course, I don't think the polls are right, and I've gone yeah. through this a lot, right? So I believe 35% of the country is locked into this bizarre loyalty to the lunatics that are running the country today.
It's like an abusive relationship, though. Like,
yeah.
They're loyal to their abuser.
They are.
And you see that in actual abusive relationships where you can't see reality. You're seeing the perception that's false. And that's that 35%.
Well, and people sometimes ask me, well, how do you get to this 35%? And if you look at the polling of people that thought that Kamala Harris was doing a good job when she was vice president, and you read Matthias Desmond's mass formation psychosis and kind of think about the numbers he has, and you know, you start paying attention to other polling that's going on, it always seems to vector back into this 35% that is an immovable group that are just will do anything they're instructed to do by their oppressor. And it's just what it is. So that leaves us 65. And I think about 5%, and this is a complete guess, but I think about 5% are the opportunists. These are the commandos, or not commandos, but the mercenaries that will simply align with whatever political faction is going to put money in their pocket. They have no ideology. They don't love the country. They're not, you know, particularly concerned about the Constitution. They will just do whatever. So that's about 5. That leaves us 60% of the country that I believe is incredibly aligned on the need to have a secure nation. They want that border defended. They want us to be a good force in the world. They want us to have a country where their families are safe. They don't want Trende Aragua to be able to take over their home or their apartment building, to extort the kind of extortion.
It's only a
that
couple.
Happens.
It's only a few of them.
That's right. But the kind of
not a big deal. The
kind of extortion that happens when you're in Mexico and the gangs find out you have an income, so they come and take 10% of it. They want to be prosperous. They want to be able to have the prosperity that their grandparents had, where, you know, at a time, median income and median home price, the home price was only 2 times.
Yeah.
Now it's more than 4.
Yeah.
It's become unaffordable. They want that prosperity back. And most importantly, they want the freedoms, the personal, political, and economic freedom that was protected by our Constitution until very recently. So I think the 60% is extremely aligned. We just now have to reach them, get them to understand what is happening, how they can act in their own interest, how they can vote in their own interest, and then get them to the polls.
Yeah, and in the meantime, it's almost like you teed up a statement for me there with the abusive relationship.
I hear I'm pretty good at that.
No plan there at all, but I mentioned it last night with the Stockholm Syndrome on a national scale, and that's inside that 35%, you're going to have to individually pull those people away from identifying with their captors and defending them and realizing that there's a completely different world.
And the crazy thing is, it is a different thing that pulls them away, every single person.
Yeah.
what wakes one person up has no effect on the next person. And so you have to actually go out and engage in conversations because you have to figure out which piece of the puzzle is going to wake that person up and go, wait a second, what? Because last week it may have been it was Obama putting kids in cages, not Trump. So you have to engage in these conversations, and it becomes increasingly difficult when the other side has been labeling us as the worst human beings, Hitler-esque, you know, we deserve to be lined up and shot. So then the other people wouldn't talk to us. And why didn't they want them talking to us? Because we were going to wake them up from their complex, right, and they were going to switch sides. Because that, once you're awake, you're awake. You can't go back to sleep. I mean, I've tried, but you can't. You're here. You're in it.
Let's use the example of our friend John from last night.
Yeah.
I mean, he's proof that there are people that are doing things that they should know, that there are no small actions when it comes to telling people the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a chance encounter of a guy who had a completely different outlook on life, who ran into a random person at an event, who then turned into talking to conservatives, and I say conservatives, not necessarily Republican, Democrat, but just truly constitutional conservatives, and realized that he actually aligned with that philosophy, though he was told his entire life that he couldn't do that. He needed to identify with his captors and his abusers and stay with them because they'll promise them the world and deliver him nothing.
That's right.
So that was a guy who, through a completely random circumstance, is now reaching into the inner cities of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
One person at a time.
That's right.
And that's how it's done. And the groups were forming. You know, we have our group in Chester County that has been going since the summer of 2021. Our first big event was fall of 2021. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where we are today from where we were 3 years ago is night and day. And you have other groups forming in Philadelphia.
And Delaware County and Allegheny County and Center County.
And we
Center
get together
County.
And it's a party. I mean, these are some really well-informed people who are ready to go out and fight. When you have flag waves in West Philly for Trump, you know, it is, you are seeing something crazy here.
Yeah, that's
just remember,
not a small
it's a party, but it's not a party.
It's a party.
It's not necessarily the GOP.
Right.
Oh, no. I mean, well, we have a party.
Yeah,
we have a lot of fun.
Yeah, a good time.
I have to drag them along, as it turns out, at least in this part of the country.
Yeah, leadership often means you're in front dragging and
that's
not
right.
behind pushing.
That's right. So one of the things we've talked about before a bunch of times is what's going on in Ukraine. And it seems to slip off the screens when it's not going well.
Which has been a lot of the time, honestly, if we're being honest. Well.
For a long time, they just simply misrepresented it, I think, in every newscast.
What was it? The Ghost of Kiev was the video game video that everyone fell for and retweeted. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that was great.
There's been
a lot of video game stuff popping up
gosh.
On the internet. And you're what?
It's between the video game imagery and the AI where, you know, you really have to look for extra fingers and lag. I mean, every video, is there a fifth, sixth finger, or there's seven? Because AI doesn't do fingers well.
No.
That is the trick. So if there's an extra finger there, you're like, I don't think this is real.
So turning then to that conflict, I mean, we're now, what are we, 2.5 years in now about roughly?
Yeah.
You know, coming up on 3 here pretty soon.
February 22.
Yeah. And so we were told for at least 2 years of it that the Churchillian figure Zelensky was leading the country to victory and that he was, you know, he's a great democratic leader and all this. And of course, we see their elections are suspended and so on. I think a lot of that mirage.
Oh, wait. Good leaders don't suspend their elections?
Turns out.
Or their churches.
They don't arrest their priests? Good leaders? Oh, wow.
It turns out. But you know, of course, they did there. And also, of course, many of us remember when the Polish priest up in Canada was arrested on a rainy tarmac with, I don't know, it had to be 15 police cars around him or something.
Yeah.
And we all remember when they shut down all the churches in the United States but kept the liquor stores open. There's a pattern that
I mean,
repeats,
honestly, yeah.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, the Churchillian mirage, I think, has melted away. And I think the...
He looks like a lunatic now. I mean, let's just be real. Like, he's lost his mind. He is really struggling.
Oh, he's having a hard time because he sees what's coming.
Yeah.
And I think he did believe that the U.S. would deliver troops is what I believe. My belief was... that the plan was to get U.S. troops on the ground somewhere around the one-year anniversary of this thing, that they realized they had to get U.S. troops on the ground. And I think there are some in there unofficially, maybe.
Right.
But did you ever hear anything about them wanting to put troops on the ground? Was that ever anything that whispered down the lane in the military world?
It was always a concern. And it just seems like these wars are started kind of like fires are started. And mm-hmm. then it's like, well, now it's already started, but now we need the firefighters.
Right.
And we're like, why? You know, we didn't start that. Well,
that's a tricky one.
Hold on there. You know, maybe we did, but it seems like those who don't fight wars are eager to send other people to fight them anyways.
Right.
And that was the concern, was if we go to Ukraine, why? There's no NATO requirement there for right. us to fulfill treaty-wise.
Yeah.
Then it becomes,
no matter how hard they've been trying.
No matter
to do
how
so.
Hard they've been trying, mm-hmm. and even though they could never do it in the first place,
right?
For lots
Which
of different
I didn't
reasons.
I didn't understand the disputed border thing as being like absolutely exclusionary to their membership. So all of these fights, all of these meetings, that yeah. I mean, it's mind blowing the time that they've wasted publicly on this NATO membership when they have disputed borders. I had no idea that was even a factor.
That's just one of them. I mean, by the time you break out, you know, the crime, the banking, and many other things, there's just, you're years away from them even getting to that point. Maybe they could someday. Who
sure.
knows?
Miracles
but
happen.
The point you're making is that Ukraine, in fact, wasn't qualified to
right.
meet the requirements to be a NATO member.
And yet we've been told as, like, just, the, you know, the regular Americans going about their lives, that this is about we need them in Ukraine or in NATO, and we're working to get them into NATO. Well, hold on a second.
Right.
How?
And we expect Russia to react somehow differently than they did.
Yeah.
And I asked people, what if Russia in the 80s or 70s had come and said, we want Mexico to be part of the Warsaw Pact and part of the Soviet Union?
Right.
How would we react to that? Probably not that good.
Right.
Now, we can get along just fine. It's kind of like one of those cases of gangs on the street. You stay on your block, we'll stay on our block, and we'll be fine.
Yeah.
But as soon as you start encroaching on our space, it doesn't matter whether or not either side's arguments are necessarily legitimate and who's the most humanitarian or anything like that. It's, you're in my space. Okay? We've promised Russia that we would not grow NATO eastward.
Right.
And we did. We promised Ukraine we'd provide security guarantees to them if they would denuclearize, along mm-hmm. with Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
Well, we kind of did. We gave them food and good clothing. Except for Trump, who actually provided Javelin missiles and some lethal aid that they actually needed.
And then they impeached him.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, again, it comes down to there's plenty of mud that is sticking to the wall on America right now because of the promises we've made that we never fulfilled.
Can I circle back? You mentioned something.
Oh, you said circle back.
I love it. It's my favorite now. I totally took it. It's mine now. It's mine. It's Ada's. You said that Putin didn't respond the way people expected him to. And from my perspective, again, no military background other than what I've read, and I've read a bit. I think his restraint in not reacting or going further, like we were told that he was going to Poland, that he had ideas on all of these countries immediately, that this was, you know, this war was moving fast and we need to protect the other countries. And I've been surprised because there have been some significant attacks on Russia, or at least on resources, you know, the Nord Stream pipeline, these things that have happened that I saw happen and went, oh, he's going to be really mad. I don't know what he's going to do because I, you know, I'm told that he is a monster. And I'm sure, you know, monstrous properties. I think all of our leaders at this point have some. But he didn't respond, I guess, in ways that I thought. And I expected more animosity towards us, to be completely honest, because it is, in my view, again, civilian view, it's a proxy war with us, that Russia is dealing with America right now. They're dealing with our money, mm-hmm. our resources, and Ukraine is, it's really hard for me to look at what Ukraine is doing with trafficking, laundering, the crimes that go on in that country and think that there isn't some legitimacy to the concerns that we or Russia has with Ukraine. So I don't know what your perspective is on how he's behaved, I guess, once he went in or to provocation. And I think there's been quite a bit of severe provocation that he's just kind of waiting on. I don't know what we're looking for there.
Well, that's one of the great challenges in a conflict like this is Is it as simple as tyranny versus budding freedom? Or is it the fact that there is that rampant crime and problems going on in Ukraine? Well, unfortunately, we can also say that, by the way, that's happening here. Do we deserve to be invaded because of that
no.
by somebody? Maybe not. Probably not. I prefer to clean it up myself.
Sure.
And maybe we could give Ukraine the chance to clean it up themselves. May or may not ever be successful. Eastern Europe is an interesting place, to say the least, having lived there. But when it comes to an expansion of a conflict like Ukraine and Russia, first of all is, do they want to? Because if they want to, any provocation is an excuse to expand. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
Providing one bullet from America to Ukraine may be all that's ever needed in Putin's mind.
You have Josh Shapiro signing missiles to send to Ukraine. I mean, you know.
That's one artillery shell, by the way. That's probably a dud. But and so just because, let's just say worst case that he wanted to. The next question is, can he? Based on their performance in Ukraine, because they're a typical poorly trained Eastern European style army in Russia, once you take away their capacity for nuclear, cyber, and space capabilities. Large volume, yes. Dangerous, mm-hmm. very.
Oh, yes.
Highly trained, well led, no. And we saw that play out. So we'll go back to that worst case. He wants to expand it. His decision is he can expand it. But now, just because you can, should you?
Right.
Because his equation is, if I expand this and I'm having a hard time handling the fire I've started, it's kind of like starting a backfire in a forest fire and it goes the wrong direction.
Yeah. Right. So when we were being told he's about to go into Lithuania or Latvia or Poland, he's going to take all of Eastern Europe, he's going to France, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Europe. He was on his way to Europe, marching towards Europe.
Non-stop.
That never seemed credible. I mean, that always seemed like just another way to get the American people to be engaged so that we would support unlimited amounts of money, unlimited weaponry. And I thought that it was a clear push to get us to put troops on the ground.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that the sale that was being offered, right, the proffered idea to the U.S. citizen was, we have to go in because if we don't, he's taking NATO members.
Yes.
And it seemed ludicrous to me because I didn't see it. So I went and listened to what Putin was saying himself.
Yes.
And then I went
that's the trick. You need to actually go listen to these people, not what they're being reported have said.
And then I went back and I looked at some of the history and looked at it again and said, wait a minute, you know, regionally, we talked about some of this last night, you know, and none of this made sense to me. So that's when I, you know, figured out that this was a plan that began to be executed at least as early as 2014. Mm-hmm. And
with the same characters, can we just mention Victoria Nuland, Jake Sullivan? These were all the people who were involved in Ukraine on Fire. That it didn't happen in a vacuum.
No.
What's the producer, director, Oliver Stone, did the documentary about it. Like, we've known all along what was going on there.
Which, in hindsight, is a really good documentary to watch. But can you just talk to us a bit about how you think, I mean, is that perception right? I mean, this goes back to 14 and the Nuland overtake, you know, the U.S. State Department changing the government and so on. I mean, the Warren Adam. Is that what really happened?
Yeah, I mean, let's just go to the 2014 date and mm-hmm. say, why is that the actual beginning of this conflict? Well, on February 27, 2014, Russia moved in ununiformed soldiers into the Crimean Peninsula, which they didn't, they took Crimean Peninsula without a shot fired because mm-hmm. it was a very permissive area for them, really very pro-Russian. And they wanted to make sure that they solidified their hold on that because that is the home of the Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol. It is a critical warm water port. It's this national pride piece as well that is huge across Russia and specifically in Moscow that this is theirs and will always be there historically. I mean, and this is going back even to the days of Catherine the Great when they moved into there.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to give that up. There's no way.
Right.
So at that point, you know, they turned the oven up a little bit, got what they wanted, turned it back down and waited. And they had an opportunity now that they basically just ramped up the temperatures on what was a slow boil conflict for 8 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so those they've been fighting the Luhansk-Donetsk region for a long time because of the cultural and historic realities of the area. And it is a predominantly Russian-speaking, leaning cultural area that identifies more with the Rostov-on-Don region of Russia than it does with out to Western Ukraine, for example.
Right. Yeah.
So in the end, because Biden did not keep a promise or make a promise to prevent Ukraine from entering into NATO and continued to message that he was going to pursue that, well, Putin said, okay, well, I can't let NATO keep growing closer and closer and closer to Russia, who's, by the way, twice been invaded and had Moscow nearly reached by Napoleon and then Hitler and his armies. History matters, and especially in nations where the conscience is a lot longer than ours. And so they said, okay, well, we're going to prevent this, and whether it's an excuse because of what happened or what is happening in eastern Ukraine or a bigger decision because they wanted to control the whole country, at this point it really doesn't matter. We gave the Putin ultimately the reason that he in his mind needed to move into Ukraine because he knew U.S. wasn't going to do anything about it. And then it's just, okay, now we're going to start having Americans throw their money at Ukraine and their material and everything and with no strategy.
No strategy and no controls. So we throw all this money and there's no oversight whatsoever. And then the report comes out that the Minister of Defense or Offense, I don't know what, Minister of War, I don't know what the title is, buys a $7 million estate in Spain.
Yeah.
Well, do we think that just came, what was he, clipping H and S&H stamps? I mean, you know, we were sending that money over there. It was clearly being laundered and distributed, and some of it came back here, if you remember, from the FTX scandal, where they gave it to FTX. FTX bought their fake Bitcoin alternative, this crypto, and shipped it back to a group of politicians that are listed.
Yes.
We have the list.
We have the names.
So it's crystal clear that it was a laundering effort.
Can I also, I'm going to bring up, it goes back a little further, I think, because as a junior senator, Barack Obama, in 2005, and I looked it up just to like double check myself because this was obviously memory hold, but he was in Ukraine working on disarming them in 2005. So, I mean, we've been kind of the same players, Obama, Biden, these guys have been going in and out and interfering or involving us in Ukraine politics. But that brings me back to the proxy war idea. Like, you know, of course we want to be involved in Ukraine. Russia's our greatest enemy. And I use air quotes because who knows anymore? We have lots of enemies. Yeah. So,
but the story we were told was a really simple story. Putin woke up one day. He's crazy.
Yeah.
He's a bad guy. He wants to take Poland. So he's going to march through Ukraine. He can't take Kiev. And he you know, put that column north of Kiev and then pulled them back into Belarus, right? So they didn't actually engage in a battle to take that city of, what is it, 3 million? They didn't actually go in and start shooting in Kiev, but they can't take Kiev, but he's going to take Poland. He's going to take Warsaw. Yeah.
They did get to the outskirts.
Yes, I mean, with that column.
I mean, it's like getting to the outskirts at this point almost of Philadelphia. How do you define that?
Yeah.
They never achieved what they needed to achieve.
And they didn't, but they didn't go in and have a hot fight for Kiev. Right.
No, if they'd wanted to, they would have pulled a lot more forces into Belarus and just moved them straight down the river to Kiev, and Kiev wouldn't be able to do much about it.
That's right. Now, it would have been a mess because it's 3 million people, and you know it's not a Russian-centric kind of area. They are much more Ukraine-centric, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about this, everything that we were told, the entire construct laid out for the American people was actually false, and the purpose of it was, in my view, to ship money and arms in. And I believed and still believe that it was eventually to get our troops on the ground.
I agree with
because
you.
Because I think the ultimate goal was removal of Putin so that the globalists could control Russia. The vast land, resources, and people of Russia are of great value. And I think that's one of the reasons why this was sold so hard to the American people. Not so much that he was going to take Poland, but that the globalists wanted control of Moscow. I don't know if that's true or if I'm just casting too much into this.
Well, it is certainly one of those potential plays on the board that we need to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always come in on stuff like that and say it's absolutely truth, but the difference is it is very reasonable, and it's how the globalists operate. They fan the flames of war for a purpose, not just because they want to fan the flames of war, because you know why does this war matter and not the brutal conflict going on in Myanmar?
Right.
They're both brutal. Why is one in our conscience every day and one of them just completely ignored? We don't know.
The fight in Myanmar is not even mentioned. It's non-existent in this country. We don't know about it.
Well, right. We might know about it, but we're weird.
We're weird.
I mean, we're a little extra.
I just call Ukraine a crime scene the size of Texas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're covering up the evidence.
And I mean, listen, there are so many things. People got banned on the internet for talking about the biolabs, but there's U.S. government documents talking about the funding of the biolabs in Ukraine. So it's been a really weird period where the lies absolutely get more attention than the truth. And then the truth is derided as, you know, crazy conspiracy theory. But if Iran set up a biolab 10 miles over in Mexico and we're taking blood from Texas citizens and testing them and seeing what things affected that blood to be specific to that Texas population as if they're, you know, a single organism, what would we do? What would the U.S. government do?
Well, let's take a look at a biolab in L.A.
I mean, you're right.
Well, there's always examples.
Never mind. Our government won't do anything, so scratch that.
But hold on. But that was an interesting point, that biolab in California, that was strange.
Yeah.
I mean, no, and that also is a story that came and very quickly disappeared.
Yeah.
This thing was run with, like, extension cords and hoses from, you know, outside. I mean, this wasn't, and they had that ability. There were police stations that the Chinese Communist Party had in the United States.
The satellite police stations. That came up and then disappeared really quickly, too.
Two rules of thumb when it comes to how close you are to the truth that's dangerous to others. One, does it disappear quickly in the major media?
Yeah.
Or two, is it in the major media, but they're attacking you as the crazy person?
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, if I'm not getting attacked, then I am not working hard enough.
Right.
If people aren't saying mean things about me, then, like, I need to step my game up. And fortunately, I'm never at a loss for it. So we're lucky that way.
So if we coming back to Ukraine, if we just say, okay, it's clear he's not going for Poland, right?
Even if he wanted to, he can't.
Can't, right. So it's off the table, never was really on the table. And he hasn't made any further efforts to really take all of Ukraine. It doesn't seem that that's a goal, but he is inching forward. And I say he, but it isn't just one man. It is an army. It is a country. You know, they are inching forward. They're not
inching,
losing.
I think, is really an appropriate word to use here because it is incremental and small.
It is. They're not losing ground. Now, there was a major attack inside Russia it was in Crimea on an oil facility that was burned. We've attacked the bridge that goes between Crimea and the Russian mainland, if you will. There have been a lot of attacks, drone attacks and things inside Russia. The only response to that has been that he just continues to press forward and then he launches some counterattacks into Ukraine. But he has ignored that on the global scale. He has simply ignored it on the global stage, I think. How far can this get pushed before he feels that it's necessary that he counterattack? And by counterattack, I don't mean in Ukraine, because he's not confused thinking that it's Ukrainians that are making this happen.
No, he knows exactly who's, I mean, you listen to him talk. He knows exactly who's doing it. I point to me. It's not me. It's our government.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. No, and that's kind of really the big question is, with this war over inches that looks indicative of France in 1918, for those of, again, history geeks and various things know what that means. It's like it's trench warfare today where no one's moving back and forth crazy. The news highlights drone attacks and missile attacks and ballistic missile attacks and rocket attacks and various things like that. None of that exchanges land, which is really what matters. All of that is a system of punishment and potentially impacting things like communications and logistics and hope, maybe. But if it were going to be truly successful to do that, it would have done so by now, the way they're doing it. So I think it just becomes a question of looking at this now sort of like a boxing ring, and you've got two boxers, you're way deep into this fight, and
they're
both
tired.
So exhausted that maybe one of them just falls over on their own. And you can't control it. But on the other hand, maybe you're going to have this thing decided by a judge.
How badly is Russia's fighting capability diminished? Do you have a sense of that?
They're still very dangerous. They started this war at a 5-1 odds. They're still very capable of doing a lot of damage. But they're significantly degraded, not only in their national morale and their fighting spirit because of what they were incapable of accomplishing that they thought they would just walk in and do, It has hurt them because they've put their entire economy on a war footing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And have not been able to do anything that doesn't support that for the most part. But a weird, I often take this a weird direction too, because I think in some cases very long term. So Russia, before this war even started, was already having a significant issue with its own population growth over time and support, and specifically mm-hmm. the kind of people who would fight this kind of war.
Yeah.
Now you've got potentially a couple hundred thousand people dead of fighting age males from Russia, and that has an exponential effect because that's part of Russia's population that was already having a problem.
Right.
So in the long run, this is badly hurting Russia.
And the problem you're talking about that Russia had already was, again, like us, they had very low birth rates. They were not at replacement rate. Their population was contracting.
Right.
And so it's not, you know, it's 140 million people. It's still a serious country. And at the time of the beginning of the war, I think Ukraine was around 40 million.
Yeah.
But there were, say, 4 million overseas and maybe 9 or 10 million left. And, you know, a lot have been injured. And so their population is, let's call it 20 million that are still there and part of Ukraine. You know, many of them were in the Donbass who weren't supporting Kiev anyway. So it's, let's say, a 20 million person country against the 140 million person country with vast resource. It is not a fair fight, right? But I wonder if Russia's fighting capability, they've lost a lot of men that were very important to them. Again, not replacing those. The country's contracting. But Ukraine also then has lost a disastrous number of people.
Yeah.
I mean, just a disastrous number.
Right.
Can they continue to fight this?
Not if it turns into the kind of warfare that actually becomes what we would call mobile again, and someone's actually trading large amounts of land. To be on the defense and maintain trenches and trench warfare takes a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
And from the military tactics perspective, offense takes a lot more than defense. And defense is, frankly, where most of them are on both sides right now, most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But Ukraine can absorb that. Now, I would say within the next year, you're going to see something happen that's going to close this thing out.
I honestly...
Because there's no choice.
There's no choice. It's got to end.
Right.
My question is for you... Because in my mind, it seems obvious, maybe. So, but again, non-military. Do you think both Zelensky and Putin are waiting for Trump to return to figure this out?
Well, I go back
to... I mean, Putin endorsed Harris. I am pretty sure that I saw that. So obviously, Harris is better for Putin because they're not interfering.
Well, I would say... I said this on a Fox News interview a couple of weeks ago, was... These leaders are hedging their bets, as they always do during an American election season. And it's sort of a Tories Whig thing. Yeah, I'm going to wait and see who wins and then say, oh, I was always on your side. So Putin wants Harris because it's more of the same or worse.
Yes.
As far as Americans
it's good
doing
for
the
him.
Right thing. Mm-hmm. It's great for him and it's great for thugs and autocrats around the world.
Right.
But they're also saying, there's no guarantee that Trump's not going to win, so I've got to... play with him a little bit. And we saw that with Zelensky here in the U.S.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, how often does a foreign leader come to the U.S. and go see somebody else like
a candidate?
Yeah.
And I love the meme. I don't know if you saw it or this short little video where they took Zelensky and shrinked him down to like an inch.
Yeah.
And had him walking like a stepchild to Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. But in some ways, that's the could be the reality of it is that Zelensky may be looking to Trump to fulfill that promise of having this thing ended and to cut a deal because he knows that given the situation that he's at now, he may have to cede some territory, more territory to Russia than they already have in order to save the rest of the country.
Well, and the people,
it's cut the hand off before you bleed out and save the body.
Yeah. Well, I think of the loss of life there, and to get nowhere is really just stunning. It's just death.
And that's what truly bothers me, and I think bothers a lot more people than may have the voice or ability to talk about it, is the price is paid by the people who had nothing to do with starting the war, ending the war. It's this global Game of Thrones of people thinking they're going to end up in power. And that is what I think we need to see end. Is just end this thing so we can stop the killing and find a way forward.
Yep.
And then while we're at it, let's put all these globalists in a box and ship them somewhere.
Honestly, I said to him earlier before he came in, I don't take my advice from people who think the world is overpopulated and that they should be the ones to decide which of us don't get right. to live here anymore. So,
and they never volunteer themselves.
They never, or their kids, yeah. or their families. It's never them. It's always, you know, all of us out here. So, right. you know, and that applies to everything, food, medication, vaccines. I mean, honestly, healthcare. I never take their advice. I found... that I live a better life as a result of not going along with their lunacy. There are a lot of people captured into it and don't even realize what they're captured into, as Gary was talking about with the climate enthusiast over the weekend at the yeah, Fall Fest. Right. That's always nice. You go to a Fall Fest to get some pumpkins and a hayride maybe and, you know, argue with someone about climate propaganda. But I did that at the primary, at yeah. our primary, at our precinct. Do you understand that after a certain level or below a certain level, we die. Like, we all die. So why are we trying to reduce carbon that low? I'm so confused. What do you mean?
And how dare we grow plant food?
I honestly, and this person had, again, had no idea that there was like a threshold where life just dies if we reduce it to a certain right. degree. And I'm like, yeah, we're not so far away from it. And we're not even close to the highest we've ever been. Like, don't you think maybe you've been fed a bad yeah. bill of goods?
Well, and I think in the end, all of this comes down to really what I highlighted at the beginning of the show or the town hall last yeah. night was if it supports and magnifies or protects life, then they're going to come after it. And not because they care about that. They want it for themselves.
Yeah.
But what they want is to control that so they can control you. Wars are a way. Famine's away, fear is away, propaganda is away, control of currencies, energy, medical freedom, like you said, the education system.
Yep.
That's frank. Let's put it out there. The abortion industry is a for-profit industry that leads to more control because they're using that money against you and destroying life.
And we're never allowed to talk about Margaret Sanger or what she believed in because that's just somehow right. against the rules.
And, you know, my final piece here is I love free speech. And one of the greatest advantages of free speech is the ability of the crazy people like the National Education Association director to be able to get in front of a camera and think that they are they can be completely unhinged and no one's going to see it.
Uh-huh. Right.
Oh, they expose themselves.
I say,
yeah.
go ahead.
Yeah, please.
Every single camera on the planet needs to be focused on people like that right now because the more you see them, the more you see them.
That's right.
We're in our generous stage. We give you all the rope you need, and right. we just step back and let you talk because honestly, sometimes that's all we need to do.
Hence, no Kamala debates and press conferences, hardly.
Oh, that town hall this week, Ezra actually tweeted, like, if you are still on the fence and don't know who you're voting for, go ahead and watch Harris's town hall and then go vote immediately. Right? right? Exactly. Like, I mean, oh.
Follow your instincts. It's okay sometimes.
Yeah.
It's fascinating that's... How 6.5 minutes online for a town hall on the stage? So, you know, as we look at this and we're looking now at this stark choice in this election between more of this death and destruction and whether or not Putin or Zelensky are waiting for Trump, he's barring election fraud. I think he's coming.
He's coming.
And so
I can't wait.
So I think if he's coming, that's going to have to get settled. And what that settlement looks like is something where we don't see Putin just run back across. I mean, it seems that those regions that are in the Donbass, you know, Lugansk and Donetsk and so on, that is going to remain part of Russia likely yeah. going forward.
I think it should.
And
that's my opinion.
Right. I mean, that's how yeah. this looks like it's yeah. shaken out.
It seems like it. And the comparison I tell to the American people is imagine Texas is not part of the United States. They have a border war with the rest of the United States over two counties in the northwest part. And somehow that becomes the entire world's problem.
Right, right. It's just, there's no way.
It's very, that's a good one. I'm going to clip that later.
So when they talk about Trump coming in and settling this, I mean, there's a clear path to getting it settled. Not everyone's going to be happy about that. If you're Ukrainian and you're living in those provinces or those areas, those oblasts, you're not going to be happy about that. But there's really just not much the world's going to do about it. So it's going to get settled and the death and destruction may stop. And then what happens in Ukraine? There's no answer for that. right? There's no yet answer for that. Of course, I think someone's already been appointed to be the person who goes in and rebuilds it.
BlackRock?
I think that's who. Yeah, I think
what?
That's the group.
I've never even heard of them before. Who are they? We don't have enough time.
So before the death and destruction even ends, you've got somebody lined up to go in and take the profits off the rebuilding.
Oh, of course. Everything is, all is a reason why the biblical model is the love of money is the root of all evil.
That's right. So look, we've got about 2 minutes left or a minute and a half left. So tell me this, you know, Darren, you're doing a lot of work around the country. You've had people involved in this situation in North Carolina. Tell us a little bit more about your organization and just how we can follow you and learn more about what you're doing.
Sure. Yeah. Me individually, you can look at DLGAUB, G-A-U-B, and that's on Twitter. It's the only social media platform that I've only been kicked off of twice. The rest of them have never brought me back. I'm on Substack. Just look up Darren GAUB on Substack. Nobody else has the name, so there you go. It's not hard to find. And I have a Rumble channel that if people take a look at my name, they'll find that as well. But the organization itself is... We say that what you want to do, and what we're trying to teach people to do is to think nationally, to think globally, to understand the situation of everything going on around you. But that's a problem. But the way to solve it is not to try to create something that's at that scale. It's to rebuild and reconstruct and bring your community together and start with the foundation from the bottom up. And that's what our County Guardian program is about on our website at restore-liberty.org. And we want to be able to say that we're going to bring together a human network across all these different counties. And while we're at that, we're going to go work with sheriffs where they can be trusted and say that we want to work alongside of you, especially if you have things like what happened in North Carolina and Tennessee with the hurricane. We're going to be there to help with trusted people already. And we do a lot of other stuff. We don't have time to explain it all. But if you're looking for an organization that is focused on trust, on faith, on community, that's us. And we come together frequently to talk about it.
Well, we'll have you on again to learn more about that. And we really appreciate you coming to town and joining us for this session of The Conservative Voice on WFDB AM 860. Ada, thank you so much. And we'll see you all next week.